It doesn't matter who we are, change happens.
I flatlined.
Sometimes it's forced on us.
You know there's more than one baby here.
Sometimes we choose it.
There's a time where you just need to jump.
But when it happens, it changes everything.
I just stopped the drugs on the Sunday.
So how do we respond to it? Join me, Ruda Landman, to explore that in our podcast, When Change Happens. Listen at changepodcasts.co.za.
He slips through the night, unseen. The window is just a crack open, just enough for fresh air, but it's all he needs to get in. As his feet hit the floor, he goes for his phone and illuminates the torch. Not only for him to see, but so that they cannot see him. And it works, time and again. Soon, he begins to wonder if they'll ever catch him. This is True Crime South Africa. I'm Nicole Engelbrecht, and you're listening to episode 167, The Serial Crimes of Sello Mapunya. And it's that time again when I highlight the latest series to watch on CBS Justice, the home of true crime on TV. And from Thursday, the 17th of October, you can catch season 5 of Cold Justice, exclusive to CBS Justice. As a Texas prosecutor for over 20 years, Kelly Ziegler successfully tried 68 murder cases. Now, she and her team help local law enforcement officers to get to the truth by bringing a fresh set of eyes plus access to today's advanced technology to a range of unsolved cold cases. Watch a standalone episode Monday to Friday at 9:20 a.m., 1:45 p.m. and 8 p.m. from 17 October to the 1st of November. On DSTV Channel 170 and Starsat 222. And a huge thank you to CBS Justice for sponsoring this episode of True Crime South Africa. Since 2019, True Crime South Africa has been telling the stories of the victims of violent crime in South Africa. The podcast is independent. That means no big or even little corporates fund it. And that's just the way I like it. And it's the only independent podcast in South Africa that consistently charts in the top 10. Keeping a podcast like this going is time-consuming, and for the most part, it remains a one-woman process. It's me. I'm the one woman. You, yes you, are the reason this podcast continues to flourish and help bring in tips on missing person and cold cases. If you'd like to help keep the show running, please consider supporting our sponsors, signing up to Patreon or PayPal, follow the show on the socials, as the kids say, and share it with your fellow partners in crime. You can find our social links and learn more about our sponsors at truecrimesouthafrica.com/donate. Shout out to this week's Patreon and PayPal superstars. A huge thank you goes out to Debbie Mills, Michelle Ledwaba, Jade Price Holmes, and Kurume Katlego for your support on Patreon. Thank you so much, everyone. Your support really does make a huge difference. Patreon supporters get one additional exclusive episode a month, a shout out on the pod, and other exclusive contents, including Q&As with me, as and when it's available. It's a minimum of $1 a month. I think you should do it. Please. And thank you. Keba. I mentioned in an episode a few weeks ago how we're seeing more and more arrests and convictions of serial rapists. I said that this had a lot to do with our DNA capabilities improving and the backlog being cleared. And in today's case, I think I discovered another two factors that have likely contributed to this. Incredible policing from specific detectives and a unit that's been formed that seems to be doing amazing work. The unit is not that new, but it really seems to now be putting out some excellent results. Although some of the victims in today's case have identified themselves in the media, I will be keeping them anonymous to stay in line with their constitutionally protected right to anonymity as rape survivors. In researching this episode, I used several online sources as well as a few summaries of court proceedings I was able to find. So, let's get into episode 167, The Serial Crimes of Cello Mapunya.
The following episode may contain sensitive material, including descriptions of violence, sexual assault, or graphic descriptions of injuries to victims. If you feel you may be triggered by such material, please consider this before accessing our content. To access trauma counseling or services, please see the helpline information on our show notes.
Although we now know that the series of crimes relevant to today's episode started in 2014, little is known about the victims of those early crimes. Sadly, by the time these crimes were tied together years after the fact, many of the early victims could not be located and would not be included in the trial against the accused. There are at least 20 victims of this serial predator who did report the crimes, including rapes, committed against them, and had rape kits taken which had yielded DNA samples from the perpetrator. But because the crimes against them fell in the early parts of the series, the investigating officer who would finally solve their cases was unable to find them. What we do know is that even then, in 2014, the perpetrator had started out as he intended to continue. His modus operandi was already set in place then, and it would serve him well for many, many years to come. The crimes in those early days of the series mirrored those in the later years, with only the weapon being used to threaten and subdue the victims changing. As is quite common with serial offenders, whether rapists or murderers, they often operate within a geographical comfort zone. This is one of the tools profilers and investigators can use to narrow down their investigation and persons of interest, as research and data shows that serial offenders will usually operate within an area that's familiar to them in some way. They've either lived there before, lived there at the time of the crimes, work there, or have family members who live there they spend a lot of time with, such as parents. In this series, all of the victims were targeted in their homes in one of five areas: Silverton, Nalmapius, Attridgeville, Mamelodi, and Olifantshoek. All of these areas are suburbs of Tshwane Metropolitan Municipality. All of the areas are within 30 kilometres as the crow flies from one another. So in terms of geographical profiling, it made for the perfect fit. There are several things that can stand against detectives investigating rape cases. The first, of course, is the trauma of the rape itself. If a victim actually wants to open a case at all, which, as we know, is not the norm, with an estimated only 1 in 9 rapes being reported in South Africa, the emotional difficulties of the victim can make taking a statement and other elements of the investigation difficult. If detectives are trained to work with rape survivors and trauma-informed, they can work around this. But there can also be other stumbling blocks, especially when a series of rapes is spread over a wide area. In this case, the rapes would have been all reported in different jurisdictions and to different SAPS officers. In South Africa, this is thankfully less of a challenge than it is in America, for instance, where neighbouring jurisdictions often don't communicate well with one another. But it does mean that unless a particularly wide-awake detective decides to contact other stations to look for more cases with similar MOs. Cases can go unlinked for a long time. The other challenge, particularly in the earlier years of this series, is DNA. You may remember me talking on this podcast about the huge backlog in DNA we had in South Africa until not that long ago. At one point, the backlog was believed to have been as much as 5 years' worth of DNA samples. But after much pushing and activism by various organizations, including DNA for Africa, in February this year, the then Minister of Police, Bheki Tshele, announced that the backlog was up to date. Still though, even in priority cases like rapes and murders, it's important to remember that it can still take months for DNA results to come back. It's not like the movies where it happens in the 60 minutes it takes for an episode to be done. And in 2014, the backlog was still a major issue. So most of the early cases in the series went unlinked for many years. It's difficult to say what effect linking the initial cases back then may have had. It may have yielded no result at all without a perpetrator to match it to. Or knowing that there was a serial predator on the run in 2014 may have been able to stop him in his tracks. Unfortunately, we'll never know. The serial predator had his crimes planned out very well. He always struck at the same time, between 1 a.m. and 4 a.m. in the morning. This is a very common time for criminals committing home invasions to strike, because it's the time at which homeowners are most likely to be in the deepest phase of sleep. The perpetrator would always look for homes where a window was slightly ajar. Although we would never get an honest statement out of the man, so we don't know for sure that he was stalking these women in the days before he struck, it is highly likely that he did, at very least, know which houses contained female residents. He would slip through the window and land silently in the home, then creep from room to room, ascertaining where the residents were. When he determined which of the residents he planned to target, he would pounce, waking his victims by shouting at them and overwhelming them into submission. He carried a range of weapons with him in his attacks. Sometimes it was a knife or a hammer, and occasionally a screwdriver. If there were children or male partners present, he would ensure that they were under control before turning his aggressions on his selected victim. All of the victims were forced to cover their faces with blankets so that they could not see their attacker's face, and he would hold the torch from his cell phone in front of his own face and into their eyes so that they couldn't see anything. As a result of this, only one of his victims would ever be able to describe his appearance. For most, it would be his voice that would stand out as something they'd never forget. The perpetrator would threaten and swear at his victims, terrorize and promise them that if they called the police, he would know, and he would come back and kill them. Years later, when some of the victims heard that voice again, there was no mistaking that this was the man who had haunted their nightmares. If he was able to easily control everyone in the house, the man often spent hours there, raping his victims multiple times and stealing cell phones, cash, and food from them. Sometimes victims said that the man was so stealthy that he would break in, rape them, and then leave without even waking up any of the other people in the household. Anna, one of the perpetrator's later victims, always worked night shift and usually returned to the home that she and her young son shared with her twin sister and her son in Attridgeville around midnight on weekdays. Careful not to wake other members of the household, Anna would say her prayers and then slip into bed beside her sleeping son. It was a ritual she followed every night when she worked, but on the 28th of January 2018, she had only just fallen asleep when she was shaken awake again. As soon as Anna's eyes opened, she was blinded by the light from the perpetrator's torch. He told her that if she didn't do what he said, he would kill her and her son. He forced her to get up and walk into her sister's room, where he made her get into the bed beside her sister and nephew. Wielding what looked like a hammer, he instructed all three to pull the blanket over their heads. Then he told Anna to remove her pants, and he raped her. At one point, Anna's nephew tried to peek out from under the blanket, and the intruder told Anna that if the child did that again, he would not hesitate to kill him. Anna would be raped several times that night, and in between, the man ordered them to stay where they were while he went into the kitchen, and she heard him rummaging in the fridge, eating the contents. After he had further terrorized Anna and her family, the man left with a threat that if they went to the police, he would come back and kill them all. Anna did call the police, though, and she was taken to hospital for a rape kit to be taken. The DNA sample gleaned would be vital. Also in 2018, another victim would have an encounter with the same man. Lindy was asleep in her home in Nalmapius with her baby when she woke to a man standing over her in the darkened bedroom. She was one of the few victims who said that she was sure the man had held a gun to her head as he'd simultaneously blinded her with the light from his phone torch. He threw the blanket over her face and told her that if she screamed, he would shoot her baby. After raping her several times, the man left. Lindy alerted her neighbours, who called the police. Soon after she was attacked, she had to move in with her grandmother. She was simply too afraid to live alone again. Most of this perpetrator's victims were in their 20s and older. His youngest victim, though, was 14 years old. And this was also the only instance in which he changed his modus operandi. The young girl was walking with her friend on the side of the road in Olivenhoutsbosch at dusk when a man pulled up in a vehicle, grabbed her and pulled her into his car. Her friend ran off to try and get help, but for her young friend it would be too late. She was raped by the man inside his vehicle and thrown back out on the side of the road. He'd forced the girl to keep her eyes closed and held his hand over them too while he raped her, to ensure she couldn't identify him. Her friend had been so panic-stricken, she couldn't really give a good description either. Some of the victims had said that the man who'd attacked them was not alone, and it seems that, as uncommon as it is, on occasion this perpetrator would bring an accomplice with him to commit his crimes. One of the victims who experienced the presence of the accomplice was Bongi, who lived with her mother Sarah in Attridgeville. On the night that the serial predator made his way into their house, she was 3 months pregnant. She and her mom were sharing a bed when they awoke to two men standing over them. Although neither she nor her mom would be able to identify the men because of the usual tactic the serial predator employed to stop his victims from seeing his face, she would later be able to identify his voice, and she knew that he had been the man who'd given the instructions, threatened them, and been the most violent. On that night, Bongi had begged the men not to rape her as she was pregnant. The man who seemed to be in charge told her to prove it, and although she was barely showing, she'd pulled up her shirt to expose her stomach, and the man seemed to decide that this was proof enough. But although Bongi was spared the physical violence, her mother was not. And afterwards, she would feel that she should have been the one that had been raped, so that her mother didn't have to suffer that fate. Bongi lay shivering in fear in bed, covering her eyes with a blanket as she'd been instructed to, when she felt her mother being pulled out of the bed beside her. She was terrified that the men were going to kill her mother, but after some time had passed, the bed beside her moved again, and she felt her mother's naked body move in next to her. Her mother was covered in soil and leaves, having been dragged outside and raped on the ground. Although the serial predator had done an excellent job of ensuring that none of his victims could identify him for more than 4 years, when he broke into the home of Tina, he finally made a mistake. Tina had woken up, and like Lindy, she was sure that the man had been holding a gun to her head. Interestingly, Tina also lived in Nalmapius, like Lindy did, so I can't help but wonder whether some aspect of this location gave the predator access to different resources. Despite her deep fear after being raped by the man, while he was rummaging around in her room for things to steal, Tina took the opportunity to peek out from underneath the blankets covering her head, and she saw the man's face. After he'd left with her cell phone and the small amounts of money she'd had in her purse, a neighbour called the police, and she was able to help create an identikit of the man. The pieces were finally starting to come together. And of course, although this was the first time his face had been seen by one of his victims, he had still been leaving proof of his identity behind on every single scene in the form of his DNA. The perpetrator had not used a condom with any of his victims, and another rape survivor was about to use that evidence to stop him in his tracks. Sergeant Refiwe Tladi was not a victim of this serial predator, but she was gang-raped when she was 13 years old. She said that although she told close family members, she'd not been given any support to report the crimes committed against her, and it had almost ended her life. She'd fallen into a deep depression after the attack, and she'd attempted to take her life 3 times. Slowly, though, she was able to pull herself out of a deep pit of despair the rapists had cast her into, and when she matriculated, she decided that she was going to spend the rest of her life making sure that no other woman had to live with the devastation of rape without justice, if she could help it. Sergeant Tladi joined the SAPS and worked her way up through the ranks quickly. Her ultimate goal had always been to work in the SAPS's Family Violence, Child Protection and Child Offences Unit, or FCS. In 2010, she made that dream a reality. Although by the time the series of crimes started in 2014, Tladi was already working in the FCS, it was a new unit that formed in 2016, which Tladi was part of, that would bring the series onto her radar. In that year, Tladi and other seasoned FCS investigators were asked to work on a new task team, which would soon become a permanent feature within the FCS, called the Serial and Electronic Crimes Investigations, or SECI. SECI is tasked with focusing on serial sexual offenders, as well as those who perpetrate crimes related to child abuse material distributed digitally. It makes complete sense to me that these crimes would have a specific task team, because they are vital to focus on, and they're also very different in nature from other types of FCS crimes, such as domestic violence or child abuse within families. And so having a group of investigators focused specifically on this is a really good idea. It's similar to how the investigative psychology unit is called in when a detective thinks they have a serial murderer in their jurisdiction. And that unit has specific skills that helps detectives to more quickly solve such crimes. That issue I mentioned earlier of rapes happening within different jurisdictions and not being tied together can also be aided by this unit, because SECI will be cross-jurisdictional. 2 years after SECI was formed, Tladi got a call from a detective in Mamelodi. He wanted advice on several unsolved rape cases he had in his area, which he believed could be linked. Tladi visited the station and viewed the dockets and agreed with the detective. The modus operandi was identical, and as she had experienced in other cases, she suspected that this offender may have committed other crimes. So she set about contacting all of the surrounding SAPS officers, and within a relatively short space of time, Sergeant Tladi had collected 56 different dockets, which she strongly believed were all perpetrated by the same individual. Even though the modus operandi was the same, the proof would be in the DNA. And slowly but surely, results trickled through from the lab that confirmed Sergeant Clyde's suspicions. All of the DNA collected from the 56 victims in the identified dockets belonged to the same man. As is the case in serial murder investigations, once a link is established, it's often necessary for an investigating officer to go back and reinvestigate each case with fresh eyes, speak to victims, check that all the evidence has been processed, and look for anything that may have been missed in the initial investigation. And that is just what Sergeant Clyde started doing. Many of the victims were surprised to see an SAPS officer arrive at their door after such a long time. And sadly, some of the victims either could not be located or had passed away in the interim. But slowly and surely, Clyde was able to start building up the dockets. And when time after time, she saw that cell phones had been stolen, she had an idea that this could be the key to catching their suspect. Clyde took the most recent case where a cell phone had been stolen and submitted a Section 205 request for location data of the cell phone. And they got a hit. In 2019, a woman was arrested while in possession of a cell phone stolen from one of the serial rapist's victims. The woman seemed horrified to hear she had a stolen phone in her possession and told Clyde that her boyfriend had given her the phone as a gift. The man's name was Selo Mapunya, and he'd been in a relationship with the woman for almost a decade. They had two children together, a four-year-old and an eight-year-old. Clyde told the woman that they needed to speak with her boyfriend, and she called him and told him that the police had arrested her and he needed to come in and explain where he'd gotten the phone. A few hours later, 33-year-old Selo Mapunya walked into the police station. Clyde said that for a long time she wondered whether this could really be their serial rapist. Mapunya was wholly unconcerned, she said, and acted as though this was all a big misunderstanding that would be cleared up soon enough. He told her that he'd gotten the phone from a friend. Clyde had always prided herself on having a very strong gut instinct when it came to the offenders she arrested. She almost always could tell when she had the right man sitting in front of her. But Mapunya was so good at claiming his innocence that she even questioned herself. But she wasn't about to let the man go without using every tool at her disposal to either include or exclude him. So she told him that she was arresting him for having passed stolen goods to his girlfriend. It was the one thing she could get him on to at least hold him for enough time to get his DNA. With the arrest made and the DNA and fingerprints taken, the items Mapunya had with him, including a sports bag, were seized and searched. Opening the bag, Clyde finally believed she had the right man. Inside was another phone, whose IMEI number matched up to one of the victims, as well as a plastic bank bag full of SIM cards. All could be matched back to the phone stolen from the rape victims in the series. Mapunya had been so sure that he could talk himself out of the situation that he'd walked into the police station with a literal evidence bag of his crimes. Clyde pushed every button she could in the next few days to get the DNA compared as quickly as possible. She had enough to charge him with several counts of possession of stolen property, But if she didn't work quickly, he could easily be granted bail on such low-level charges. While waiting for the DNA, she also called in Tina, the only victim who'd seen the serial rapist's face, and arranged an identity parade. The young woman began to shake uncontrollably the minute her eyes fell on Selo Mapunya in the lineup, and she had no hesitation in identifying him. Clyde's pleas for a quick turnaround on the DNA results did not fall on deaf ears, and within 9 days, she and her team and all the victims were advised that they did indeed have their man. Selo Mapunya was linked through DNA to all 56 dockets. In the end, the man would face 101 different charges when his trial began in 2021. Mapunya had been so convincing that he'd had a seasoned detective second-guessing herself until she saw the DNA results. And even after he was biologically linked to the crimes, he continued to deny his guilt. He pleaded not guilty and insisted that there was some mistake. He was continually disruptive and arrogant in court and changed his legal representation 4 times. He insisted on having a Sepedi interpreter, even though he'd spoken English with several of his lawyers and the police, and often exploded in verbal tirades at photographers in the court. When Mapunya did this with victims present, the women would often dissolve into tears as they were taken right back to the night he stood over them, hissing and swearing for them to comply. Although it would have been far easier on everyone if Mapunya had pled guilty, it was, of course, his legal right to plead not guilty, and the prosecution was confident that with their mountain of evidence, they would secure a conviction anyway. They began with the testimony of the survivors, who testified as to what each had endured on the night Selo Mapunya had broken into their homes and raped them. Then the prosecution began to present the DNA evidence, which was compelling, and apparently Selo Mapunya thought so too, because at the start of the next trial date, his attorney told the courts that his clients wanted to change his plea. With that, Mapunya pled guilty to 71 of the charges against him, including all of the rape charges, which had made it to trial. The state continued to present the rest of its evidence, including the visual identification by Tina and the cell phone evidence. When the state rested, Mapunya's lawyer indicated that his client would not be taking the stand to give evidence. Although he had admitted his guilt, neither the court nor the victims would ever get any explanation, insights, or apology from Mapunya. It was as though he just concluded a particularly annoying business deal which hadn't gone in his favour, and he wasn't prepared to engage any further. Despite Mapunya's refusal to engage, during the sentencing portion of the trial, something mentioned in mitigation of sentence could give us a clue about his activities in and around the crimes. His defense counsel stated that the judge should consider that Mapunya was a father of 2, who was the only breadwinner for his children, and he'd made his living by carrying out peace jobs, which included transporting items for people in the Tshwane area using his vehicle. In my mind, it's highly likely that it was this job that had given Mapunya, first, his comfort in the area of operation, and secondly, probably also gave him the opportunity to observe the people living in the area and identify victims he wanted to target. Of course, the attempt at mitigation was ridiculous, considering the magnitude of the charges against the man, and the judge thought so too. On the 26th of May 2021, Selo Mapunya's sentence was handed down. In respect to the rapes, where the victims were raped multiple times, and also the crime in which Mapunya had targeted a minor, he was handed down life sentences, 5 in total. For the other rape charges and the robbery and housebreaking charges, he was handed down a total of 988 years. The court erupted at hearing this, with victims sobbing in relief and hugging each other, as well as a beaming Sergeant Rafiwe Tladi. Interestingly, according to quite a few articles I read, the judge noted that none of these sentences should be served concurrently. Now, this is either a matter of a journalist misunderstanding what the judge said, or a bit of an odd determination which could definitely be challenged on appeal. Because in South African law, whenever a life sentence is handed down, and Mapunya was given 5, all other sentences automatically become concurrent. This is because a human being only has one life, and is therefore considered to be serving all of their sentences at the same time when they have a life sentence. Unfortunately, I could only say for sure if I was able to get my hands on the sentencing document, which I haven't been able to find, unfortunately. But this wasn't the only reporting error I saw in this case. And honestly, I'm becoming more and more concerned about the quality of court reporting in this country, especially when it comes to understanding charges and sentences. Now, please be assured, I don't consider myself any type of legal expert, but I've learned a bit along the way in the last 5 years. And these are glaring errors I'm seeing. Besides the concurrent sentencing mention, which, if it did come out of the mouth of the judge, should have been clarified by a journalist, I also saw many news articles reporting incorrectly on the number of rape charges Mapunya was found guilty of. As I mentioned, he was found guilty of 35 counts of rape and 36 other counts, which included housebreaking and robbery. Far too many news sources thought it would be okay to just add those numbers together and claim he was convicted of 71 rapes. And the press release from both the NPA and the SAPS was quite clear, if read for understanding and not regurgitation. In addition, I saw another bizarre trend, which seems to happen when the media perhaps wants to create more shocking headlines, where they take the determinate number of years handed down, in this case 988, and just decide that they can add on 25 years for each life sentence to that number to create a bigger number. So in this case, you'll see many sources reporting on 1,088 years because they took the 5 life sentences, multiplied that by 25, and added 100 to the 988. This, of course, is wrong because a life sentence is not 25 years, even though an offender does become eligible for parole at that point. Now, you may be sitting there going, okay, Nicole, does this really matter, though? The guy's going to jail for a long, long time. Why bother with the semantics? But in my opinion, and from a victim-focused perspective, both present and future victims, it does matter. When we as the general public are given an incorrect view of what charges, sentences, and legal terms mean by journalists we trust to report factually, that misinformation gets passed on, and most importantly, victims get the wrong impression about what this means for them. I already saw it happen in this case, with victims saying they are grateful he'll be in prison for the rest of his life. And while that is probably and hopefully true, it's not necessarily an absolute. Setting aside the strange and probably ineffective alleged ruling of concurrent sentencing, Salo Mapunya will, by law, become eligible for parole in 25 years. So, in 2046. And how many of his victims have been told that? And how many are going to be horrifically re-traumatized when they, hopefully, receive a call from the Department of Correctional Services in 25 years. And these errors in big media house articles are just helping to reaffirm these incorrect and future traumatizing assumptions. So yes, It does matter. And yes, hashtag not all journalists, because there are excellent journalists out there who do the work to understand what they're writing about and report accurately because they understand the consequences of what they're doing. But even one incorrect article is too much, in my opinion. And I get it. I made mistakes when I started doing this too. And I still do when I come across new, complex legal situations. But I correct things when I find them to be inaccurate. And really, these are very simple errors which only take the correct reading of a press release to understand. We really need to do better in this regard. With that said, it's highly unlikely that Solo Mapunya will see the outside of a jail cell for a very, very long time, if ever. And his victims can now move forward with some semblance of vindication and justice. Sergeant Refiwe Tladi explains how vital she's come to understand justice can be in the healing of victims of violent crime, especially rape, with which she is sadly very familiar. She says that one victim told her that when she was raped, it was like a coat was removed from around her, and from that moment on, she felt naked in the world. And when her rapist was convicted, it was like that coat was put back around her shoulders. I don't think we can really say enough about Sergeant Tladi and her incredible work. This is not the first serial rapist she's put away, and it won't be the last. And although police officers and those in similar roles are always warned not to make the work personal, sometimes it can't be helped. And I think sometimes when balanced with a lot of personal healing, it can be helpful, not just to the officer, but also to the victims they assist. And with every rapist Tladi puts away, she says, a small piece of her own justice is retrieved. Anna said that the conviction and sentencing meant that she could finally take her happiness back from Solo Mapunya. On the day he raped her, she said, he stole her happiness. And on the day in court, when he was found guilty and sentenced, she took it back from him. Bongi, whose mother Sarah was raped by Mapunya and who herself still lives with a form of survivor's guilt, expressed gratitude, which was largely tempered with a dose of realism. And it's with her short quote that I want to end this episode, because I think it speaks to the long journey ahead and how after the celebration of victory, there is so much more to be done. Bongi told a journalist, I keep on asking why. Why couldn't I save my mother from this trauma? Why could I not save my family from this horror? I blame myself for not being able to protect my family. I don't know if we will ever be safe. It's not just him out there who commits these crimes. There are others. To each and every victim of this serial predator, I hope you feel the coat has been placed back around your shoulders and that all of you take back some part of your happiness. If you'd like to hear more victim-focused true crime content, please subscribe to True Crime South Africa on Spotify or the platform you're using to listen right now. If you're looking for something still related to real-life stories, but often with a more positive slant, you can check out my new podcast series, I Live Through This. You can follow both podcasts on social media. We're on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. I'll be back next week with another episode. Until then, thank you for your support, and I'll chat to you soon.